eyes, oi, 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 all persons having business before the United States Court of Appeal, will get your claim, draw nigh, and give your attention, for this honorable court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. We're convened this morning to hear the case of Henderson versus Mansfield. Council ready to proceed? All right, but council will state their names for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tom Stover, Arnold and Porter LLP for Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Stover, welcome.
Is the court Richard Mayer for the government? Seated at the council table with me is Leslie Rogal.
Morning. All right, there was an amicus. Is amicus planning to argue in this case?
Your Honor, amicus has advised me that they do not plan to argue this one.
Okay. Mr. Stover, you have 30 minutes to argue. Do you wish to reserve any of that time?
Yes, Your Honor. I've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Chief Judge Green, and may it please the court. Mr. Henderson is here today making essentially one argument, and that is that he is asking this court to apply settled precedent in this case and to find that 38 U.S.C. Section 7266A was told for a period of 12 days, during which time Mr. Henderson was physically and mentally impaired. I want to be very clear about that. We are asking the court to apply settled precedent. The Veterans Administration is before you today asking the court to deviate from settled precedent, to ignore the holdings in both Supreme Court and Federal Circuit cases that control the decisions of this court. The settled precedent that Mr. Henderson refers to are the cases of Irwin v. Department of Veterans Affairs, Bailey v. Department of Veterans Affairs, Jakeway v. Department of Veterans Affairs, Barrett v. Department of Veterans Affairs, and Arabus v. Department of Veterans Affairs, and all of those cases have been cited in the pleadings and papers before you. As I mentioned, we believe these cases all control this court's decision in this case. I'd like to turn for just a moment, if I may, to the concept of stare decisis, because I think it underlies a very important point that this court has raised, and that is, what is the effect of the decision in Bowles v. Russell? As the court is aware, stare decisis is a concept that underlies all jurisprudence in the United States. The Supreme Court has made it very clear in its holdings that only the Supreme Court can overrule one of its cases. I'd like to direct this court's attention to the Supreme Court decision in Rodriguez versus Shearson-Lehman, which is at 490 U.S. 477. In that case, the Supreme Court made it very clear that only on-point precedent applies until the Supreme Court says otherwise, and that only the Supreme Court has the prerogative to overrule its own decisions.
Mr. Stover,
yes.
Let me just ask you a question in that regard. Does the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims consider claims from VA, or does it consider the decisions of the Board of Veterans Appeals?
The Court of Veterans Appeals, as constituted by statute, considers appeals from the Board of Veterans Appeals.
And individuals take an appeal to the court for that purpose?
That is correct. Let me rephrase that. I would say that individuals take a case from the Board of Veterans Appeals to this court for the purpose of judicial review of the BVA's decision. One thing that I think is important, and if I'm jumping ahead of your question, Chief Judge Green, please let me know, but one thing that I think is important for this court to bear in mind is that you are the first opportunity that a claimant has for an independent judicial body to review his or her claim. And I think that is essential when looking at the case law, both the Irwin decision and its progeny.
So you make a distinction between the fact that this is an appeal from an agency as opposed to an appeal from a district court to a circuit court?
Judge Sholin, I am following the reasoning of the Federal Circuit in the Bailey decision and the Jakeway decision. And in those cases, that's essentially what the Federal Circuit said. They said, this is a court that provides judicial review for the first time to a claimant. And in that respect, it's very different from the situation in Bowles. Because as you recall in Bowles, what happened was you had an individual who had filed a habeas petition in a district court. The district court ruled on the habeas petition. The individual then had a period of 30 days in which to file a notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals. That period expired. The individual then went back to the district court and said, hey, you know, I did not get the notice of final decision. And under Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 4A6, the district court could say, look, there was a problem getting the final decision to this individual. We're going to give you 14 additional days. And that fact pattern is very different from the fact pattern that a claimant, and certainly than Mr. Henderson has here, because Mr. Henderson has never had a court review the decision by the BVA.
That's correct. However, he has received a notice of appellate rights from the VA, so that puts him in a slightly different position than a traditional litigant filing in a district court for the first time.
I agree. He's in a very different position than a traditional litigant.
And in Stone versus INS, the appeal from the Board of Immigration Appeals to the Court of Appeals
right.
was the first step.
In Stone versus INS, the Supreme Court looked at a host of factors that actually followed Irwin. And what Stone said is, we're going to look at the statute, the context in which it was created, and a variety of other things to try to determine what the intent of Congress was. And as you'll recall, what the court did in Stone is say, based on what we read in the statute and what we can divine about the intent of Congress, we conclude that equitable tolling isn't available under the statute that was controlling in Stone. And I'm sorry, Judge Sholin, I want to go back for just a minute to something you said. I think I misheard your question. You asked me if Mr. Henderson was different than a traditional litigant filing in court for the first time, and I apologize. I thought you said in the Court of Appeals. And to address your question, I think the answer is, in many respects, Mr. Henderson is very similar to an individual who is filing in, for example, a district court for the first time. And this is actually another point of distinction with the Stone v. INS case, because there you have an Article I court that has reviewed a decision by the Immigration Service, and the appeal is not to a court of first instance like this court. The appeal is rather to the Circuit Court of Appeals. And I think that that is also a distinction that the Supreme Court fastened on when it looked at the law and the underpinnings of what Congress's intent was in ruling on Stone. So I hope that I've corrected my answer to your question, but I apologize for mishearing it before.
Yes, but you know, sort of the underlying point that I was trying to make is that he has received some notice of what his steps are and what the time in which he has to file, as opposed to someone filing, say, a sexual discrimination suit for the first time or whatever in district court, as opposed to going through the EEOC.
Well, that's an interesting point, and I would say in some cases you're right, and in some cases that's not correct. For example, in Irwin, the individual right. at issue in Irwin clearly had the steps laid out for him right. on how to appeal through the EEOC system, and then once that system was exhausted, to go on to the district court. Those steps were spelled out in the materials provided by the EEOC, and that's made clear in the Irwin decision. If you're talking about an individual who comes in and files a contract action or a business tort or even right. a criminal action in a district court, you're right. Those steps aren't laid out. But I would suggest respectfully that really is a distinction without a difference, because what we know in this context is that through Bailey and Jakeway and Barrett and Arabus, it doesn't matter that the BVA decision contains a complete listing of all of the steps that need to be taken, equitable tolling still applies, or is still available, I should say.
I'd like to focus a little bit on the language that the Federal Circuit has used with regard to the uniqueness of the veterans claimant scenario. Do you think that that provides a basis for potentially distinguishing Bowles if we were to have a broader interpretation of Bowles?
Absolutely it does. I mean, clearly what the court has said, and I think this is true in Irwin and in Bowles, is that that any court must look to the intent of Congress when making a determination about whether or not equitable tolling applies in a particular circumstance. And the intent of Congress, particularly in the veterans context, couldn't be any clearer. And I think that that Judge Michel in the Bailey case and his concurrence in the Bailey case, as well as statements in Jakeway and subsequent cases, make it very apparent that that this system is created to be paternalistic and benevolent, and from that context, we can infer certain things about what Congress intended veteran to be available to veterans in this type of litigation.
What I'm struggling with, I'm sorry.
Just to follow on that, where do you find in the legislative intent the intent for that paternalistic environment to apply to in this court?
The answer to that question is, I don't find it in the legislative intent. I find it in the decisions from the United States Supreme Court and from the Federal Circuit. And I know that the Supreme Court has said that we must presume that when Congress legislates, it understands the backdrop against which it legislates. And that's important not only in answering your question, Chief Judge Green, about legislative intent. It's also important when you consider the issue of whether equitable tolling applies in 38 U.S.C. 7266. Because as we mentioned in our brief, Congress has had at least two opportunities to specifically say equitable tolling is not available to veterans when they appeal from the BVA to the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. And in both of those instances, Congress has chosen, for its own reasons, not to so legislate. And so I would respectfully submit that Congress's silence in the face of three or four Supreme Court cases and now many, many more Federal Circuit cases suggests that Congress at least is in agreement with the way the courts have characterized the veteran system.
Would it be instructive, though, that in the formulation of the legislation to create this court, in one version of creating an Article I court through the Board of Veterans Appeals and allowing for a 180-day period to file the appeal unless good cause is shown?
I understand where you're going. Yes, sir.
Okay. And then the determination not to use good cause but to strike good cause and just say, really mirror what the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure provide.
My response to that question, Your Honor, is that the Federal Circuit has looked at that issue, and that issue has been briefed in a number of cases, including cases that I have briefed in the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit has determined that Congress's decision to strike the language that was proposed by the Senate, which you just quoted to me, and use the language that was proposed by the House, which is 120 days, without the good cause shown exception included, does not exclude equitable tolling from the operation of 7266. And I think that as long as the Federal Circuit takes that position, again, I go back to the point I made at the very beginning, that's controlling precedent that this court must follow.
And we have no obligation to follow a Supreme Court mandate if it was determined that such an action was indeed mandatory and jurisdictional.
If I could build on his question,
sure.
How can an implicit legislative intent that we're divining from Congress's failure to act overcome a potentially explicit mandate from the Supreme Court that this is jurisdictional and something that we cannot extend?
Two answers to that question. Number one, there is no such mandate from the Supreme Court. So you're posing a hypothetical question, because clearly Bowles did not overrule Irwin.
Well, let's pretend that it did.
I understand, and that's why I go to the second point of your question, which is that this is a hypothetical. And I think that in a hypothetical scenario, first off, it's difficult to predict what would happen in a hypothetical scenario. But in a hypothetical scenario where the Supreme Court says Irwin is no longer good law, then I would submit that the proper thing for this court to do would be to wait until the Federal Circuit has addressed this issue by specifically overruling Bailey and its progeny. And then this court would have direction from the appellate court that's immediately above the CAVC and rule on the basis of those decisions.
Because you see an underlying separate basis from Irwin in the Federal Circuit jurisdiction?
I'm sorry, Judge Shulman, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Because I believe in stare decisis, and I think the rules of stare decisis are such that this court's decisions are controlled by the Federal Circuit, and it's up to the Federal Circuit to determine whether or not there is a separate and independent basis for allowing equitable tolling under 7266. And if the Federal Circuit makes the determination that Irwin is the only pillar on which the determination in Bailey rests, then the Federal Circuit will overturn Bailey. And if the Federal Circuit overturns Bailey, then obviously this court will follow that precedent.
I have a couple questions. First of all, as I read your response to our request for briefing, your position is that Bowles did not overrule Irwin because Irwin was not discussed in the Bowles decision.
Yes, Judge.
So Irwin remains good law.
If I could just clarify our position, yes, you're correct, but I think the reason that Bowles didn't overrule Irwin goes beyond just the fact that it wasn't discussed. But I'm with you so far.
Why doesn't overrule Irwin?
I think in some respects, Bowles and Irwin are in line. Bowles looks at congressional intent, and that's what Irwin did too. Bowles stepped back and said, Justice Thomas stepped back and said, what did Congress intend? And in particular, what did Congress intend with respect to Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 4 and 28 U.S.C. 2107, the habeas petition statute? And what Justice Thomas determined is that as between those two statutes, it was Congress's intent that equitable tolling not apply. Oh, pardon me, I misstated that. It was Justice Thomas's determination that the doctrine of unique circumstances does not apply. And I think that that is similar in many respects to what Justice Rehnquist did in the Irwin case, because what Justice Rehnquist did was take a look at the EEOC statutes and say, look, Congress has decided to waive sovereign immunity in this instance, and Congress legislates against this backdrop, knowing, you know, what's going on out there in the world, and Congress knew that it waived sovereign immunity. The doctrine of equitable tolling typically applies in private suits under this statute, so why shouldn't it also apply in governmental suits? That analogy, that looking at Congress's intent, was carried forward in the Brockamp decision. And it was discussed in Stone v. INS, as Chief Judge Green and I have already discussed. So I think that in many respects, particularly in this notion of looking for the intent of Congress, Bowles and Irwin are in alignment.
Well, in my view, in Bowles, the opinion with regard to the unique circumstances doctrine only responds to an argument made in that case by Mr. Bowles. Well, or I'm not sure if it was Bowles or not, by whoever the petitioner was.
It was Mr. Bowles, yes, Your Honor.
And in the decision, when they talk about the unique circumstances doctrine, they talk about it in response to an argument made.
Mm-hmm.
But let's assume that Irwin stands. Irwin said you can have the basis for Irwin's application of the rule of equitable tolling has two prongs, does it not? One prong, it seems to me, is that an individual has diligently exercised their desire to appeal. The other prong is that they were misled in some way and relied on that detrimentally relied on that, on some action by the adversary. How, even if Irwin survived, how did either of those help you?
Well, they help us
in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. They help us because what the Federal Circuit has said in Bailey and
well,
Jakeway.
Bailey is a detrimental reliance case.
And Jakeway and Arabus mm-hmm. and
this is,
Barrett.
This is not.
Arabus and Barrett are close analogies here. And in both of those cases, the Federal Circuit said, under Irwin and its progeny through Bailey, we have determined that in cases where either an individual, a claimant, is mentally impaired or physically impaired, that will be sufficient.
Those are more unique circumstances cases, aren't they?
No, Your Honor. No. The unique circumstances doctrine was not recognized in those cases, and indeed the unique circumstances doctrine was rejected by the Federal Circuit in the OJA case. I think the reasoning in Arabus and Barrett was pretty clear that they relied on Irwin and the doctrine of equitable tolling.
Okay, let me ask you this question.
And I see that I'm running out of time.
That's all right.
Okay.
I'm sure that the chief will allow me.
Yeah, we can manage that.
That's fine. I just didn't want anybody to...
The second question I have, which is probably more, direct, is how do you explain what appears to me very clear language in the admittedly brief opinion of the Supreme Court in Bowles that would indicate that where a time limit is imposed by Congress, it is jurisdictional and not subject to tolling?
I think the answer to that question comes from a couple of places. First, I think the court has to bear in mind the specific question that the Supreme Court was presented with in the Bowles case. And the specific question was, and this is Justice Thomas's words, the question before us is whether the Court of Appeals lacked jurisdiction to entertain an appeal filed outside the 14-day window allowed by Section 2107C, but within the longer period granted by the district court. That was the question presented. And in that context, I think that the broader statement made by Justice Thomas, which is cited by the Department in its brief with respect to equitable expansion of congressionally mandated periods of time is really, in many respects, dicta. That's one answer. I think the other answer to your question is that the Supreme Court, in its jurisprudence, in looking at Bowles and in looking at Irwin, has made a distinction between statutes which govern a period of appeal from a district court to an intermediate court of appeals versus what the Supreme Court has from time to time referred to as a statute of limitations or an appeal period in a context like this one where you have an individual who is bringing a claim for judicial review for the very first time. And I think that that is also a distinction between the language that you refer to in the Bowles decision and the situation that we have here, as well as the situation that was presented in Irwin, because recall that Irwin was also a case where an individual was moving from an administrative body, the EEOC, into a district court. That situation is a much closer analogy to what's before this court than the situation where Mr. Bowles, who, recall, had 30 days to file a notice of appeal, failed to do so, was given an additional 14 days under the rule, by mistake 17, because the court erred.
Under the statute.
Under Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure.
Which is a statute.
Fair enough. That was given additional time under that statute to go ahead and bring his appeal. And the Supreme Court makes a distinction, and I'm sure the court is aware of this, but the Supreme Court in Irwin and in Brockamp directed courts to look at a variety of factors when deciding whether or not equitable tolling was available. And one of the things they...
Not whether it was available, whether or not Congress, in enacting the statute, had left some room for equitable tolling to be applied.
I accept that characterization completely, Judge Hagel. Absolutely right. The Supreme Court directed that courts should look at whether or not there is, for lack of a better term, a safety valve already built into the statute.
What factors apply in our statutory scheme that would cause us to apply equitable tolling here?
Well, the Federal Circuit has addressed that again in the Bailey and Jakeway cases very clearly, and the factors are that there is no evidence, either because the period of time is not repeated over and over again as it was in the Brockamp case, or because there is already an exception afforded as there is under Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 4A6, the Federal Circuit has determined that this is evidence, using the factors established by the Supreme Court, this is evidence of the fact that Congress intended 7266 to
so
be...
The factors you would state are that the time period is not repeated over and over. And what is the other factor?
The other factor is that there is no other built-in safety valve, if you will, that would allow for an extension of the period of time for good cause shown.
If there's no other built-in safety valve, doesn't that make the words all the more clear?
Well, not according to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has said pretty clearly that if there's no built-in safety valve, that, in fact, is evidence that Congress did intend equitable tolling to be available.
Okay, Mrs. Stover, you're at 25 now, so I'll...
I'm ready to sit down, Your Honor, unless there's any further questions for me at this point.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Murray.
May it please your court. It's the Secretary's position that Bowles is a new bright line rule and that Irwin and Bailey and the progeny of cases is overruled. There can be no doubt about it as far as the Secretary is concerned based on the language that Bowles uses. Bowles states that a statute-based time limit is jurisdictional, which is, it's mandatory. It's not subject to exceptions. It's made the classic distinction, Bowles did, between separation of powers. What Congress hath put together, let no court take asunder. And what Bowles says is it acknowledged the area of the law concerning jurisdiction and what is jurisdictional and what is mandatory was very ambiguous, confusing before Bowles. And I think what the Supreme Court was saying is this is where we're going to start regarding this whole murky issue that's been going on for years and years, that Congress is the one empowered to tell federal courts what kind of cases they can hear, which cases they can hear, and under what conditions they can hear them. And to find that out, Bowles says, you look at the statute. The court cannot artificially extend its own jurisdiction by changing the statute passed by Congress. In this court, 7266 provides that an aggrieved party shall file an appeal with this federal appellate court within 120 days. There are no exceptions. Bowles said that today we make clear the timely filing of a notice of appeal is a jurisdictional requirement and courts are powerless to create equitable exceptions to jurisdictional requirements. The Secretary can't say it any plainer than that.
Well, is the clarity of the words that you point to undermined by the Supreme Court allowing the Kuykendall decision, which did apply equitable tolling based upon Irwin, to stand?
Your Honor, not at all. To try to impose one's interpretation or one's feelings about what the Supreme Court's silence was in denying certiorari in that case, and in trying to impose one's own view on what that means and to hold that out as authority is just a novel legal position to me, Your Honor.
What about the Supreme Court's failure to comment on the dissent discussion of Arbaugh or Irwin in the majority opinion in Bowles, well, by only discussing the Harris case?
I don't think that matters, Your Honor. I mean, of course, it would be a much clearer decision if it had discussed every single case that came before it on this issue. But I think we're all lawyers here, and everybody knows that's not how courts work. That any time a prior law or a prior case is in conflict or inconsistent with the newest, most recent, highest court's decision, then that prior law is no longer any good. You do not have to specifically list every predecessor case that this new decision affects. § 7266 is such a jurisdictional statute. Bowles says, let's look at the statute to see congressional intent. Did Congress intend to provide any sort of equitable exception to this 120 days? There's nothing in the statute, Your Honor, and it could be argued that's as far as you need to look. There is absolutely nothing that would allow a court to provide equitable extension of that 120-day period. But looking further into the legislative history, as Judge Green talked about, it is clear that when Congress passed the Veterans Judicial Review Act, it had on its mind, it knew about, it talked about whether or not to provide this good cause provision. It decided not to. It made up for it in other ways, extending the time period to file an appeal from the House proposal. Probably, I'm not sure, but it's got to be one of the longest time periods to file an appeal in the federal system. And I remember there was also talk by the Senate to make it simpler to file an appeal by not having to file a petition like normally a claimant or a person pursuing a claim would have to in another federal court, a whole petition. All you have to file with this court is a notice of appeal. So the Congress was very aware of what it was doing when it passed the Veterans Act, Your Honor, and it decided not to include that. You can't get any more clear about the legislative intent. I agree with you
about the clear language in Bowles. It's not just in the quote you cited, it's in a number of other places in Bowles. For me, the question is resolved to this. Is there something in the uniqueness of this court when it operates to review decisions in a system that is self-described as paternalistic and generous to veterans that would cause us to find that we are so unique that the clear language does not apply to our statute, much of which was discussed by Chief Judge Michel in his separate statement in Bailey?
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. As Bowles recognized, it was announcing a rigorous rule. This is a good point, I think, to also mention that this court is an independent federal court of appeals. As I mentioned in my pleading, the federal circuit, I think, many times loses sight of that by referring to this court as being included in the paternalistic system. I mean, it's an easy mistake to make, I think, unless you've been dealing with this area of the law for a while now. And that blurring of that line between the paternalistic agency, the paternalistic administration, and this court, I think, has caused a lot of the problems. This court is an independent body, Your Honor. There is nothing that Bowles says except that it's a rigorous rule, and if Congress wants to, it can address that. This isn't an anti-veteran case. Bowles was not pursued by the Department of Veterans Affairs to try to get rid of cases or try to block veterans from having their day in this court, Your Honor. But as Bowles clearly states, that this court cannot provide equitable excuses for a veteran's noncompliance with the very clear and fair rules about adjudicating. It's a brand new day, and that's where we work from. I don't think it's good enough.
Excuse me if I may interrupt. Can we draw any guidance from the several other circuit courts of appeal that have looked at Bowles since its decision and have fairly limited its reading?
I'm not aware of them, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Taking what you're saying, Mr. Myrick, is that does it appear clear to you then that Congress's specific designation in 7266 of a notice of appeal as opposed to complaint or petition for review or whatever perhaps distinguishes or falls in line with the concept that this is in fact a notice of appeal or Congress's intent that there would be a mandatory jurisdictional time limit?
Yes, Your Honor. It's unquestionable as far as the Secretary reads it. And again, the legislative history would bear that out. I think it's important to go back to talk to note Congress. I'm sorry, the Supreme Court's acknowledgement of how rigorous this rule may appear in some circumstances, and many people may look at it that way in the circumstances of veterans' claims, but it's kind of like it is what it is, not to be callous about it. And the court has said, the judiciary cannot change the legislative intent, and it will not presume an intent when there is none. And looking back to legislative history, there is no more presumption of congressional intent. It's either in the statute or it's not. In our case, it's not in the statute. Your Honor, it's very clear that all cases, let me back up one second, that this court is empowered to not have to wait for the Federal Circuit to rule on Bowles. This court is empowered, as any federal court is, to look at Bowles and decide whether or not Federal Circuit cases that came before it are overruled to the extent that they allowed equitable tolling. I don't think this court has to wait. This is a federal court. You can apply Bowles the way you see fit, and if it's inconsistent with what has come before, you can say that in your ruling. I don't think there's anything more that I wish to say at this point.
Any other questions?
I have one, maybe more than one question. Appellant's counsel argues that the law of the circuit is that equitable tolling applies in our cases, and he cites several cases by which the Federal Circuit has indicated it applies. Bailey, they all emanate from Bailey. Why is it that the rationale in Bailey does not say that we are so unique that we should not apply the rule established or reestablished, as Justice Thomas would say, in Bowles to this case?
I'm not sure that that's what the Federal Circuit said in Bailey, Your Honor, that this court
is. Tell me why not. Well, tell me why we shouldn't apply.
Well, it's the Secretary's opinion, Your Honor, that Bailey went farther than Irwin led it. I mean, if.
Yeah, but it's still. Don't quibble with the rightness or wrongness of Bailey. My question to you is, if that's the law of the circuit, and that's the appellant's argument, that's the law of the circuit, and that's the law that we must follow, and then let the Federal Circuit sort it out between their precedent and the Supreme Court.
I understand, Your Honor, and I suppose if that's the position you would want to take, you could take that. But as I just said,
I'm asking you why we shouldn't take that, why we should or shouldn't take that position.
Well, because Bowles is so clear, Your Honor. If this court would like to wait to see how the Federal Circuit handles it, it certainly can do that. In the Secretary's mind, there's no reason to wait for it. Cases will be coming from this court to the Federal Circuit, and I'm sure they will be, no matter how this turns out today, they will be have ample opportunity to deal with it. There's nothing preventing this court from giving its view of what Bowles says in relation to all these other prior cases.
Okay, let me ask you another question. Even assuming, let's assume that we found that Bowles did not apply here. Does the veteran win in this case? Win in the sense that the Secretary's motion to dismiss the appeal is granted.
If this court were to find Irwin had any viability left, Your Honor, I believe it would have to find that the presumption that Congress intended for equitable tolling of cases was rebutted through the legislative history, through the plain language of the statute.
Well, no, let me try to rephrase that a little bit. Let's assume that we're back pre-Bowles, right? In other words, we find that Bowles doesn't apply. Under the facts of this case, you know, certainly Mr. Henderson didn't file in time.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and the Secretary files a motion to dismiss as appropriate. And Mr. Henderson comes back with a number of documents for the court to consider. Among them, a statement from a psychiatrist and a statement from his wife describing why he could not have complied with the statutory filing deadline to file his appeal. Now, what's the Secretary's position with regard to whether or not the facts of this case, if it were pre-Bowles, were to actually satisfied the requirements for equitable tolling?
I understand. I'm sorry for misunderstanding your question earlier. I was at another level with that question. Frankly, Bowles takes us so far beyond that question in my mind that I don't know that I have a position.
The Secretary has to have a position on this.
Well, I do believe that the doctor's opinions finally hit on the language that would allow this court to find that if equitable tolling did apply, it would apply in his case.
Well, let me try to state it another way so I can make sure I understand your answer.
Yes, sir.
Under the facts of this case, excluding Bowles, would the Secretary, I guess, withdraw its motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we would withdraw it. We would await the court's decision on whether or not Mr. Bowles.
What would be your position with regard to whether or not equitable tolling should be granted in this case on the facts, excluding Bowles?
If equitable tolling were still alive, then the position, and I'm sorry for my ambiguous answer, would probably be yes, it would apply, and I suppose we might consider withdrawing our our dismissal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I was struck by something that I heard over and over again in Mr. Mayrick's argument for the Secretary, as well as something that Judge Hagel raised. I did an informal count, and Mr. Mayrick used the word clear 13 times during his argument. He used the phrase, it could be clearer, once. And that was with respect to an argument about whether or not Irwin had been overruled. I think the Secretary has to concede that Irwin is nowhere mentioned in the majority opinion in Bowles, that Irwin is not explicitly overruled by the majority opinion in Bowles. And given those two factors, I think it is important for this Court to bear in mind what I would describe as very clear language from the opinion in Hone, which is another Supreme Court decision discussing the principle of stare decisis. And if the Court will permit me, I will read a short passage. The Supreme Court said, this is not to say opinions passing on jurisdictional issues sub silento may be said to have overruled an opinion addressing the issue directly. Our decisions remain binding precedent until we see fit to reconsider them, regardless of whether subsequent cases have raised doubts about their continuing vitality. Now, I would suggest to the Court that that is clear language. It is clear language about the principle of stare decisis, and it is clear language that leads to the inexorable conclusion that Irwin remains good law until such time as the Supreme Court specifically overrules it.
Well, tell me why.
You're the chief.
Well, you made me forget my question. I
can keep going for a minute if you
If Bowles, let me see, in Irwin or in Bailey, the Federal Circuit, would you say that the Federal Circuit had considered 7266 provision a claims processing rule? And if they do, or if they did, if Bowles had existed at that time when it stated that a statute that expresses a mandatory time limit would be jurisdictional, how would Bailey get around that?
Your Honor, I don't think they considered it a claims processing rule. And I have to confess that I don't recall the specific language in Bailey on this issue. And I'm sure that there's some guidance from the Federal Circuit in there. But I don't think that Bailey considered 7266 a claims processing rule. I think that what Bailey said, and certainly what Jakeway said, citing to Bailey on this point, is that 7266 is a statute of limitations. And as a statute of limitations, 7266 is subject to equitable tolling. Bailey applied the rebuttable presumption contained in Irwin, that presumption that Congress intended to include equitable tolling in statutes of limitation.
How does it become a statute of limitation?
How does 7266 become a statute of limitations? Well, if I follow the Federal Circuit's reasoning, and it's certainly up to them to clarify it, not up to me, but if I follow their reasoning, they consider it a statute of limitations for the very reason that we were talking about a few minutes ago, and that is, this is the first court that a veteran has access to for review of their claim. In much the same way that the district court was the first court that an EEOC claimant had access to for review of their claim. It's important also to bear in mind something that Judge Scholin raised with respect to the Kirkendall decision. There, the Federal Circuit, not in the context of looking at 7266, obviously, but taking a look at what at statutes that are also intended to provide veterans benefits, and relying heavily on the decision in Bailey, the Federal Circuit determined that equitable tolling applies in the VEOA context. The Supreme Court had the opportunity to hear that case. And although we don't know exactly what happened, we do know that at least six justices on the Supreme Court determined, number one, that there was not a sufficient issue there for plenary review, and number two, that the Kuykendall case was not sufficiently analogous to the decision in Bowles to require a grant, vacate, and remand, the GVR. It's also interesting to note that the government's position in filing a petition for certiorari in the Kuykendall decision, colleagues of Mr. Mayrick's and certainly a fellow branch of the government, took the position not that Irwin should be overruled, but rather that the analysis of Irwin, that is to say that the reading of congressional intent performed by the Federal Circuit was incorrect, that the Federal Circuit simply got it wrong when they were looking at Congress's intent. So the Solicitor General, at least in the Kuykendall context, has taken the position or has argued that Irwin remains good law. It's just that the analysis done by the Federal Circuit was incorrect. I want to go back, just circle back around to what I said at the very beginning, and that is I think that this court is controlled by the principle of stare decisis. I think it's clear that Irwin has not been overruled, despite what the Secretary might say on that front. Yes, there is broad language used in the Bowles decision, but the Supreme Court has made it abundantly clear that until and unless they specifically overrule one of their cases, it remains good law.
Well, if I could perhaps make the Secretary's argument for him for a moment, couldn't Irwin and Bowles coexist in a different way than you suggest, which is that for time limits for appeal, equitable tolling is no longer available, but for other types of statute of limitations or rules, whatever other vehicles one might get to a court, that you look at congressional intent to determine whether a equitable tolling would be permitted?
Let's use your hypothetical as a starting point. If that were to take place, Judge Sholin, it would be my contention that 7266 is still subject to equitable tolling, because just like the statute at issue in Irwin, which was a statute that controlled, again, that controlled the time period for taking an appeal from a decision of the EEOC into district court, 7266 governs a time period of taking a decision from the BVA, an administrative body within the Department of Veterans Affairs, to this court. An Article I court created by Congress, a separate independent federal court. And the analogy between this circumstance and the circumstance in Irwin is so close that even if the hypothetical that you just proposed were to be the case, I would say that equitable tolling still applies in 7266. Recall that in Irwin, the Supreme Court did not go back and look at the congressional intent in the statute in the same way or to the same depth that they went to in Brockamp. And recall also that in Brockamp, what the Supreme Court said is, look, you've got a statute in the tax regs that says you've got a specific period three or four times over that ties those that period to specific levels of recovery that one could obtain, and pointed out very specifically that there was this sort of pressure valve within the system that would allow an individual a little bit of additional time to file if, in fact, there was a problem. None of those things exist in this case. So it's our contention that under the decision in Irwin and Brockamp and the progeny, that 7266, that congressional intent suggests that 7266 is subject to equitable tolling. I want to address one last thing that was raised by Judge Hagel, and that is the issue of whether Mr. Henderson, assuming the court finds that Bowles doesn't apply, that whether Mr. Henderson has met the test for equitable tolling.
It seems to me the Secretary conceded that.
And I think that's right, and I think that the only thing I would say that is, if Mr. Mayrick, upon further giving this matter further thought, decides that the Secretary is not going to concede, I think that Mr. Henderson has indeed met the test. The statements from his doctor and his wife very clearly show that the physical and mental impairment, which Chief Judge Green has already found exist, were in fact the direct cause of his failure to file. And I just wanted to be sure that it was clear that that's Mr. Henderson's position. And unless there are any further questions, I think I'm done. Thank you very
much. What's your view of the other circuit's treatment of Bowles?
Your Honor, I have to confess, like Mr. Merrick, I am not familiar with the other circuit's treatment of Bowles beyond what the Supreme Court has done in Kirkendall. I do know that the Supreme Court issued a GVR in a case called Mitchell, which is another criminal case, habeas case, and I know that that was sent back down to the, I believe it was the Seventh Circuit, for further review based on the Bowles case.
Would you not agree that the treatment of Bowles by the circuits would be instructive to us?
I think that the treatment of Bowles by the circuits would certainly be instructive. However, I would say that it is, as I've said before, it is the Federal Circuit that controls. And at the moment, under the controlling precedent, which is Bailey and its progeny, it is clear, could not be clearer, that equitable tolling is available under 7266.
And you're not aware of any treatment by any of the other courts of appeals of whether or not their NOA can be tolled?
Well, I would say this. NOAs to other courts of appeals, it seems to me, would be distinct from a notice of appeal to this court, for a number of reasons, some of which we've discussed here, including the benevolent paternalistic system in which this court operates. But I think that, again...
Stop there a minute.
Yes, sir.
I have to ask the question, because you put us back into that environment, and I want to make sure I understand where that legislative intent is that puts us in the same paternalistic environment that VA's in.
You asked me this question before, I think, and I think the answer is I cannot point you to a specific statement from Congress, but I can certainly point you to several statements from the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And I think the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, as well as the Supreme Court, have made it very clear that the veteran system is intended to be a benevolent and paternalistic system in which the veteran is given the benefit of every doubt and assisted at every turn.
But we are not tasked to do that in independent judicial review.
I think that in terms of independent judicial review, that is correct. I would argue, however, that in terms of getting a case to the merit, to its merits before this court, that means getting a case to the point where a notice of appeal is, a viable notice of appeal is on file, that a veteran remains in that benevolent paternalistic system.
Such that then, does that explain the Federal Circuit's language in the case I cannot name, but I know the facts, where an NOA is filed at the regional office, that is filing with this court because it's seeking relief from the Secretary? Does that sound familiar?
Give it to me again, Judge, I'm sorry.
Filing an NOA with the regional office is filing an appeal in this court because it's seeking relief from the Secretary.
You may be talking about the Jakeway case?
I think so.
Okay. That's a case I have a little bit of familiarity with.
Right.
In Jakeway, Mr. Jakeway filed his notice of appeal with the VARO. The VARO sat on that notice of appeal, did not return it to him, did not send it on to the court, did not send it to the BVA, but sat on it for, and I'm doing this from memory, so you'll have to forgive me if I get the length of time wrong, but I believe it was 7 months. And what we argued to the Federal Circuit is that the VA has an affirmative duty to do one of two things. Either get that notice of appeal back to the veteran so that they can get it onto the court in a timely fashion, or forward that notice of appeal onto the court. And what the Federal Circuit determined in Jakeway was that the principles of equitable tolling, as enunciated in Bailey, do apply under 7266. And by providing a notice of appeal to the VA, the veteran has sought the VA's assistance, and the VA has an affirmative duty to assist. And if it doesn't, equitable tolling stops the running of 7266 and allows the veteran additional time to file a notice of appeal with the court.
Thank you.
And did I address your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Anything further? We will greet the bar, and then the case is submitted, and the court will be adjourned.
All rise. The court is now adjourned.